Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is grading the Biden foreign policy. Today marks 6 months since Joe Biden was inaugurated as president. With me to assess how his administration's foreign policy is faring so far is Daniel Dresner. Dan is professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a contributor to The Washington Post. He has written widely and well in too many journals, magazines, and newspapers to recount. He has, if I have the number right, 8 books to his name, the most recent being Toddler in Chief, What Donald Trump Teaches About the Modern Presidency. And you may have caught him occasionally on Morning Joe. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
As I noted in the introduction, today marks 6 months since Joe Biden took the oath of office, which, if my math is right, means that 1/8 of the Biden presidency, or at least his first term, is in the books. How would you assess the Biden presidency so far, Dan, given your college professor used to grading people?
Given that I'm a college professor, it's so tempting to give the easy out and just say I'm going to give him an incomplete because it's only 6 months. But if we assume that the term ended now, I think I would give him a solid B+. Part of that is because Biden, in some ways, this is going to sound weird, but Biden came into the office with expectations about as low as humanly possible. Which is, you know, if you remember, he was inaugurated. There was no one at the inauguration. There was a pandemic ravaging the country. The country was still recovering from the immediate events of January the 6th, not to mention the 4 years of Trump administration chaos, I think would be the right word to use in terms of foreign policy. And so the question is, given all of that, how well has Biden done in sort of restoring what we would have hoped that U.S. foreign policy would look like in terms of America's standing in the world? So the good news to report is I think, you know, if you take a look at the polling data, surprisingly, people are pretty favorable towards the Biden administration. You know, I think the Pew data is the one that is the most reliable, and it shows that essentially, you know, most of the rest of the world now thinks of the United States the same way they did 5 years ago prior to Donald Trump taking office. That is promising. It suggests that maybe there won't be as much of a lasting scar. Biden has also clearly resuscitated some structures that had been left in disrepair. I think the fact that he was able to get a summit of the Quad leaders within a couple of months of taking office was a big deal.
May want to say what the Quad is.
Sorry, yes. The Quad being the United States, Japan, Australia, and India. That was a structure that actually the Trump administration was also interested in making something useful out of, but they didn't go so far as to actually have heads of state talking. You know, beyond that, you've seen sort of Biden's first international tour, going to the NATO summit, the G7 summit. That, I think, again, and an EU summit, again, reasonably successful. There seems to be a potentially ambitious tax deal in the works, which is something that's surprising.
This is the global corporate tax.
Right, exactly. And it's something that I don't think anyone would necessarily have expected to come to fruition a year ago. So there are ways in which the United States seems to be, and of course, the U.S. has reentered the Paris Climate Change Accord. They're talking at least about reentering the Iranian nuclear deal, though we'll see what happens there. So in many ways, Biden has carried through on a lot of his foreign policy promises. But to critique, there's a couple areas and there's a couple of issues where the administration is either seems caught on the wrong foot or they're just slow. Let's start with the just slow part, which is this administration has been agonizingly slow when it comes to foreign policy and national security appointments. Now, they've been faster than Trump, but that's an incredibly low bar. You know, if you look at and compare, you know, things like ambassadorial appointments or deputy and assistant secretary appointments compared to either Bush or Obama, it's not close. They've been very, very slow on this. Part of this, I assume, is due to the 50-50 nature of the Senate, but I don't think that's actually the primary reason because Republicans, by and large, with a few prominent exceptions, there's been enough of them to willing to vote for appointments that I don't really think they've actually had any serious blocking power. I do think what this is about is Biden's pledge of trying to make, you know, his national security team and his foreign policy team look like the rest of America. So I think there's an emphasis on diversity that previously had often been talked about in a rhetorical way. I do think Biden is intent on following it through. But this also means that clearly they've spent a lot more time sort of finding people. And so that's been somewhat slow. And then the other issue, I think, with respect to the Biden administration is they they've been a little bit surprised on some things, and I'm not sure how they're going to play out, namely migration at the southern border, which again has increased significantly, which is not surprising given the sort of relative state of vaccinations. And then also the cyber realm. You know, on Monday, we know that the United States, along with the European Union and Great Britain, blamed China for a ransomware attack conducted via Microsoft Exchange. We know that they've talked about other ransomware attacks coming from Russia. This is one of those areas, though, where it's not clear whether the Biden administration isn't succeeding or whether the successes are not visible. Because the problem is they're coming from places like Russia and China. It wouldn't surprise me if the United States was actually able to try to get Russian and Chinese authorities to cooperate, with the proviso being that they don't actually publicly acknowledge that fact. So that still remains to be seen.
Dan, I want to get into some of these specific issues. Before we talk about China or talk about Russia or talk about Iran, I still want to do a little sort of general assessment. And as you know, no secret, Joe Biden ran against Trump's foreign policy, criticized Trump and the job he had done. But it's one thing to be a candidate, as you know, it's another to be president. Where in foreign policy has Biden actually changed Trump foreign policy? And where has it been more or less the same?
Well, I'll answer the second part first. The areas where it's still the same are primarily on foreign economic policy. We haven't seen much in the way of tariffs that were imposed during Trump's myriad trade wars on China and other countries actually lifted. And, you know, if you listen to the Biden foreign economic policy team, they sound pretty Trumpy. You know, they want to talk about a foreign policy for the middle class, that they need to rewrite the rules of globalization so that it benefits Americans. There's not a lot of difference in terms of substance between what the Biden administration is doing and what the Trump administration was doing. The differences there are first rhetorical. Obviously, they're not, you know, there's a more consistent message coming from the Biden administration in that sense. And also, it seems like the Biden foreign policy team actually knows how to run the gears of government a little bit better. But that said, what's striking in terms of foreign economic policy is not the differences with Trump, it's the continuity. I think that the distinct differences, actually, hold on, there is one other similarity, which is, and this comes through in Afghanistan and the Middle East, which is, I think that Biden has also sort of looked at the world and said, the last thing the United States needs to have is continued costly engagements in the Middle East. And so Biden, as a result, has announced that the United States will withdraw from Afghanistan by September 1st. There was a deep reluctance by the administration to get terribly involved in the Gaza conflict a couple of months ago. It wouldn't surprise me if the administration tries to draw down its forces in both Iraq and Syria. And this is all consistent with the interim strategic guidance that they issued back in March, I think it was. The differences, I think, are in both process and substance. On process, the Biden administration is just a lot more multilateral than the Trump administration. The Biden administration and the Biden foreign policy team believe in working with allies and partners and keeping allies and partners in the loop. And even if this doesn't necessarily mean working through formal international organizations, it means, you know, engaging in what George Shultz famously called gardening before launching foreign policy initiatives. So Shultz in his memoirs talked about the need to make sure that allies and partners were cared for and tended to and didn't feel like they were cut out of the loop. The Trump administration was notoriously bad at this. It looks like the Biden administration is much, much, much better at it. And then in terms of substance, I guess I would say that the Biden administration seems more willing to focus on, and I apologize, this isn't a sexy way of putting it, but what I would describe as non-agentic threats to the United States.
You may have to explain that, Dan.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're in the foreign policy game, you know, and even the Biden administration has talked about operating in a world of great power competition, you know, the question is, who are the threats to the United States? You're looking at other actors or agents out there. And usually those actors are great powers like Russia and China, or they are violent non-state actors like Al-Qaeda or ISIS or what have you. You know, if the pandemic taught us anything, however, it's that some of the greatest threats to what we would consider national security aren't conventionally coming in the form of human actors. They're coming in the form of a pandemic disease or environmental shocks or extreme catastrophes and disasters coming from climate change. Or in the case of maybe cyber, it might be an actor, but it's an actor that's so small that asymmetrically they can do things that actually cause significant and systemic cascade failures. And so it's a world in which the Biden administration seems acutely conscious, particularly on climate change, but also they've been focused, I think, much more on the pandemic than a lot of commentators would ordinarily assume. And it's because those are the things that really do have the potential to disrupt daily life in the United States. If you take the mantra foreign policy for the middle class seriously, seriously, then one of the things you want to be concerned about is that people can go about their lives without necessarily having to wear masks all the time, and that people are going to feel safe in their homes as opposed to being subject to tornadoes or hurricanes or other sorts of natural disasters. And so I think this means that the Biden administration wants to work multilaterally to address both of the sort of epidemiological threat and the ecological threats that we face in the world.
One last general question here before we talk about specific issues, and that is, has there been anything about the Biden foreign policy that has surprised you that you didn't expect 7 months ago?
If there's one thing that surprised me, I think it's the ripples of tension in the transatlantic relationship.
How so?
Well, the transatlantic relationship has sort of taken place on two tracks. And the first being, of course, Biden saying America's back and being willing to meet with the president of the European Union, talking to G7 partners. And I think if you take a look at sort of the rhetorical level, there's a lot of bonhomie, I guess, you know, in the sense of they are happy to be dealing with Joe Biden as opposed to Donald Trump. And to be fair, the Biden administration has taken steps that I don't think Trump would have done. For example, announcing that the U.S. would not sanction Germany over and Russia over Nord Stream 2 would certainly be a very prominent example of that.
This is the pipeline to bring gas from Russia directly right to Germany, bypassing Eastern European countries that to some extent depend upon the dues or royalties they collect from allowing the transit.
Right. And this, of course, there's concerns that this puts Eastern European countries at a disadvantage vis-a-vis Russia and also potentially gives Russia leverage over Germany. In addition to, so that's the sort of, you know, on the surface. I think deeper down, I think the Biden administration has been somewhat surprised at how much European officials actually still embrace neoliberalism as we talk about it in terms of sort of an open form of globalization, because that is not necessarily what the Biden foreign economic policy team believes. And so this doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be an inevitable clash, but I do think that some of the Biden officials were surprised by the pushback they've been getting from some of the European officials.
Well, why are they surprised, Dan? Because all I have heard about the Biden team is they were experienced veteran diplomats, many of whom who speak the languages of Europe, spent a lot of time in Europe. So how can it be that now they're suddenly surprised that the Europeans actually kind of like globalization and neoliberal approaches?
Because the foreign economic policy team, while being very smart and having some background, aren't necessarily Europe experts and they're not necessarily diplomats. And it's easy to look at Europe and think, oh, no, they want, you know, a more managed form of capitalism. And it's not exactly the way Europe thinks about this, which is they believe in the sort of, you know, liberal international order, and they particularly believe in the economic dimension of the liberal international order. And so there are issues that the Biden administration wants to, or policies that the Biden administration wants to execute on things like industrial policy or government procurement or what have you, that are fundamentally at odds with how the Europeans think about this. And so you could argue that paradoxically, the Biden administration is suffering from the problem that previous U.S. administrations have actually succeeded in erecting an order that the Europeans bought into, and the Europeans are still believers in that order.
Well, let's shift and talk about some specific challenges, and let's begin with China, since the Biden administration has basically said China is priority number one in foreign policy. How do you assess the Biden foreign policy? Maybe a question preliminary to that. What exactly is the Biden policy toward China?
This is where I really do think that you have to give an incomplete grade, because I think the Biden policy towards China is an interesting mix of both aggression, but also indications of a willingness to deal. So, you know, with the Trump administration, it was all sort of China, China, China. And then below that, this desire to cut this trade deal and, you know, abstain from criticizing China on human rights, on Xinjiang, and so on and so forth. That's not the way the Biden administration is playing this. They have made it very clear they're going to articulate opinions when it comes to human rights and democracy. We saw that in Anchorage most prominently when U.S. and Chinese officials had some pretty strong words towards each other in front of the cameras. Now, my understanding is that once the cameras were off, they actually did also nonetheless have a productive conversation. And so if that's true, then it suggests that the difference between the Trump approach and the Biden approach here is that the Biden people are perfectly willing to call out China on a whole variety of issues publicly. They've also made it clear that on issues where they think that mutual cooperation can be beneficial to both sides, on the pandemic, on particularly on climate change, they're willing to engage Chinese officials on that as well. And I also think the Biden people aren't, you know, they're pragmatists or they're realists in the sense that there are certain problems in the world out there, which in order to solve them, you're going to have China sitting at the table as opposed to being on the outside looking in. The interesting question question is how the Chinese are going to take all this. And that's the part where the jury is still out, because the China of 2021 is not the China of 2017 or of 2011. You know, it's a more autocratic state now than it used to be, as Xi Jinping has consolidated power. And it's also, you know, a state with, frankly, more blood on its hands. When we look at how they've dealt with Hong Kong, when we look at how they've dealt with Xinjiang and how they've dealt with the Uyghurs there. So, you know, this creates challenges for any U.S. administration, which is to say, is it possible to engage in tactical degrees of cooperation while in the strategic side, acknowledging that China represents the greatest state threat to the United States, and also that China is evincing a way of life that is fundamentally at odds with the way the U.S. practices?
Is it possible to square that circle down?
I think it's possible.
Anything from history that tells us about this?
History does not. No, I unfortunately, history would be pretty pessimistic about this. You know, generally speaking, rising powers and established powers, you know, when we encounter what is called a power transition, or as Graham Allison popularized it, the Thucydides trap, usually it ends in a war. It hasn't ended well. And the exception to that often proves the rule, the exception being the rise of the United States relative to the United Kingdom in the late 19th century. But those were two states that had a lot in common. The United States and China do not necessarily have a lot in common. Now, that said, the other sort of way in which this is different now is that we all have nuclear weapons. So China does not think the United States is going to invade it. And likewise, the United States does not think China is going to invade the U.S. And so that puts stark limits on what this great power competition could look like. But I confess that you look at a situation like Taiwan, you know, where China has been increasingly, you know, assertive in claiming that there is only one China and that Taiwan is a part of it. And in contrast, U.S. officials who are being ever more explicit in saying, we are going to conduct diplomatic relations with Taiwan, whether you like it or not. That seems like an easy flashpoint in which you could have some sort of militarized dispute, although obviously I hope not. But no, you have to look at that situation and think the next 10 to 20 years could be problematic, particularly because a lot of observers sort of assume that China is effortlessly rising and then will eventually eclipse the United States. I'm not in that group. I actually think China has far more weaknesses than is commonly acknowledged. And if China stops growing or slows down, and as its demographics start to catch up with it, it begins to fall further behind, that's when I start to get concerned, because a weak China is just as dangerous as a strong China in some ways, in which they could then decide to act in an even more provocative way.
Dan, as you know, a key part of the Biden administration's China policy is to essentially round up like-minded countries to take a common stance against Beijing. So I have to ask you, how well is that effort going? Are countries rallying behind Biden's leadership to put pressure on the Chinese?
I think in the abstract, yes. In practice, it still remains to be seen. I mean, again, this is where the Quad Summit, for example, I think was a great first signal. The fact that the United States was able to get the leaders of Japan, Australia, and India to, you know, have a summit and also publish a joint op-ed in the Washington Post, in which I don't think China's name was ever actually said, but it was very clear what, you know, they were all agreeing to in terms of dealing with China. That's certainly a, you know, a positive signal. There are two questions, I think, about this going forward. The first is how much Europe is going to be on board. And this, again, is another area where I think the Biden administration might be a little surprised about the degree to which Europe is not necessarily on board with this. I mean, remember, during the transition, Europe actually signed a foreign investment deal with China, despite the fact that Jake Sullivan and others were very explicit in saying they didn't want to see that happen. Now, that deal is subsequently been sort of put on hold because, in the end, Europe agreed with the United States on a variety of policies towards China that sufficiently angered Beijing so that that deal has been somewhat disrupted. But, you know, if you take a look at let's say, the German trading relationship with China, they're not going to be willing to give that up necessarily. And so I don't know how broad the coalition is going to be. The second issue is that it's one thing to have everyone agree in principle that, you know, we will deal with China in a coordinated fashion. Then the question becomes, well, what specifically are we talking about? Are we talking about not buying 5G equipment? Are we talking about, you know, taking a stand on Taiwan or the South China Sea or what have you? And this is where I don't think there has been any necessary flashpoint where that's been tested yet. So, you know, if you're the Biden administration, I think you have to be pleased because, you know, rhetorically, it looks like you're in a stronger position than the United States was, let's say, a year ago. But that said, it hasn't been put to the test yet. And so this is where the incomplete grade does come in.
Okay, let's talk about the other great power, Russia. How would you assess Biden's policy toward the Kremlin?
I actually think this is where Biden gets higher marks, in that Russia seems, I think, legitimately confused at times in terms of the United States. And I mean that in a good way, which is, you know, prior to Biden, the pattern of the previous four presidents had been incredibly consistent, which is, you know, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump all came into office pledging a reset or warmer ties with their Russian counterpart. They would then try to engage in those warmer ties. And then as the administration, you know, evolved, in inevitably there was a souring, you know, or a disillusionment. We saw that with respect to Clinton. We saw it with respect to Bush. We saw it with respect to Obama. And with Trump, it was just sort of too scatterbrained. But I would say it also looked that way. When Biden came into office, there was no reset. There was no idea that the relationship would potentially have a reset. And I think, again, it's compared to those very low expectations that Biden has done a decent job of simultaneously, again, calling out Putin when he feels necessary, calling Putin a killer, you know, accusing Russia of aiding and abetting ransomware attacks and so on and so forth. But it was also interesting that Biden pushed for the bilateral summit and that summit, in terms of concrete accomplishments, you know, didn't achieve a lot. But you might argue that it was sort of lancing an open wound in that it seems that for the United States, their goal is for Russia to not be at the top of their policy queue. And by sort of conferring a summit with Putin and Biden, nonetheless, calling them out on a variety of things, they've made it very clear. They've actually sent, I think, a relatively clear signal to Russia of, look, we don't want to escalate tensions any further, but if this line is crossed or this line is crossed, yeah, that's going to lead to repercussions. Other than that, we're going to be focused on China. So, you know, just stay out of our way. It's probably been one of the clearest messages I think the Biden administration has sent. Whether it's actually been effective is, again, an incomplete thing. But I will note that this is an administration that has no illusions when it comes to Russia. And I think because of that, it's impossible for relations to get worse. I also don't think relations are necessarily going to get any better, though.
Well, let me ask you, Dan, about a criticism I've heard from people who dislike the president's policy toward Russia. And their argument more or less goes along the following lines. The Russians have been either allowing or encouraging a variety of bad actors, criminal groups to attack the United States, engage in ransomware attacks and similar kind of cyber attacks. The Biden administration has not overtly responded. This broadcasts a message of weakness in its undermining American foreign policy. Is that the right assessment, the wrong assessment?
I think it's the wrong assessment. I mean, Biden at the summit, I believe, actually said that, you know, if there were additional ransomware attacks or cyber attacks attributed to Russian state officials, that who knows, there would be, you know, critical infrastructure in Russia that might go down. Now, we've seen a ransomware attack since then, although it's not necessarily from a Russian state actor. And if this is where I confess I haven't followed up the details, but I do believe those actors have actually now been forced offline, which, if so, suggests that the Russian government was assisting in that operation. But that said, you know, this is in some ways kind of like mowing the lawn in that, yes, you will potentially knock out these sorts of ransomware attacks for the short term. The question is going to be over the long term, does the Russian state continue to aid and abet these kinds of actors? And also, I guess the other question is, at what point will the Biden administration decide the line has been crossed and will engage in offensive cyber operations? Because they have talked about that. And I think it's clear that they've talked about it in the sense of, we want to threaten this precisely because we don't ever want to actually have to use it.
Do you think they would tell us when they begin that? Or is that something we'll find out later because David Tsang or the New York Times has really good sources?
It might be, again, it might be an escalation, which is it might be that the first offensive cyber attack would be one designed so that it's not public in order to make it clear so that Russian officials know this happened. And by the way, if this happens again, then it's going to be larger and will then be more public. I mean, if I was the Biden administration, that's basically how I would, you know, plan the ladder of escalation. That said, if you do that, there's also going to be incentive for some official to leak to Tsang or, as you said, the fact that this actually happened. So I don't even know if a covert attack could necessarily stay covert, but that would strike me as the way in which this would proceed.
Let me change topics, Dan, and ask you about Afghanistan. Joe Biden, as a candidate, didn't talk about leaving Afghanistan entirely, talked about leaving behind counterterrorism capacity. As president, he has gone for full withdrawal. What do you make of that?
I think what you have to do is go back to the Joe Biden of 2009. I mean, if you recall, when the Obama administration came in, Obama ordered a review of Afghanistan policy. And Biden was the outlier in that review, which is that essentially the Defense Department convinced Obama that what should be pursued in Afghanistan was not just a counterterrorism program, but rather a counterinsurgency program that, you know, it added significant amounts of state building. Biden at the time thought at best it should be counterterrorism and also frankly thought that U.S. forces should get out. He's the president now. And I think in some ways he's approaching Afghanistan the exact same way that Obama approached Iraq, which was there was a deal in place that the George W. Bush administration negotiated for the departure of U.S. forces. Obama simply decided to continue to implement it because that was what he wanted to do anyway. I think in some ways that's what you're seeing with respect to Biden and Afghanistan. The fact that the administration is also trying to make sure that they get all the Afghan interpreters and helpers out of Afghanistan in order to avoid, you know, a sort of Vietnam in 1975 moment is telling. I will say this is an area where I think Biden is legitimately reading the U.S. public mood in the correct way, which is I don't think there is much appetite in the United States for U.S. forces to stay in Afghanistan at this point. And also, from a strictly realpolitik perspective, my hunch is that what Biden and his foreign policy team figure is that if the U.S. withdraws from Afghanistan, yes, the Taliban might actually take over. The problem is that the Taliban is then going to be confronting multiple actors that aren't keen about the Taliban taking over, namely China and Russia and to a lesser extent Iran. And so, you know, I basically think that what has happened is the Biden administration is saying this is not going to be our problem anymore. We have been in this country for 20 years. If we can't do anything now, better to walk away than to continue to expend blood and treasure in a place that is not really a strategic U.S. interest anymore.
Let's talk about Afghanistan's neighbor to the west, Iran. There was a lot of talk last fall if Biden won, we were going to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal. Well, again, we're 6 months into the Biden presidency, and we haven't seen much in the way of progress on that score. It's not clear if it's going to happen or when it will happen if it does. How do you assess that aspect of it, given that there's very real concern that Iran will begin to enrich nuclear materials to weapons grade?
The answer here is I think the next month is going to be critical. So there was an election in Iran, and I should put election in quote marks, because while it was an election, Iran's Guardian Council did what it usually does, which is it blackballed candidates that would have been perceived as more widely popular. But essentially, this is a situation where the Supreme Ayatollah Khamenei had his protege installed as president. And since that person will not take office, I think, until next month, this does give a window in which, in theory, the U.S. could rejoin the JCPOA. And the ideal arrangement for the Iranians is that if this happens and sanctions are lifted and the Iranian economy manages to grow a little bit, then the new hardline president gets to take credit for that. If sanctions are lifted but the economy continues to stay stagnant, that elected leader can then blame the Rouhani administration for whatever faults were laid in the reentry of the JCPOA. That said, the next couple of weeks are going to be crucial because I assume that the odds of the JCPOA being revived from the U.S. perspective go down the moment that Iran's new president, who I believe is personally under sanction by the U.S. government, officially takes office. And here the reports are confusing because I've heard reports that say that essentially the negotiation to some extent is already pretty much done. It's just a question of whether the political higher-ups sign off on it. But that said, since I've heard that, there's been no movement since the Iranian election. So, you know, this is one of those things where what we don't know is, you know, it's like the Titanic and the iceberg. Are we only seeing like nothing on the surface, but actually there's stuff going on under the water? Or in fact, is there no iceberg whatsoever?
Fair point. Let's close, Dan, by talking about some smaller issues that I would imagine have been preoccupying the president, certainly his national security staff, over the last several days, and that is the assassination of the president of Haiti and protests that have broken out in Cuba, the largest protests that have happened, I think, in my lifetime. Yeah. So I'm curious on this. How do you assess what the Biden administration is doing in the light of two things? One, President Biden has talked about putting human rights at the forefront of American foreign policy, promoting democracy, which seems to be on the table in both the Cuba issue and the Haiti issue. But the second thing is, as you alluded, part of what is driving Joe Biden is an assessment that there's not a big appetite among the American public for foreign military interventions. How do you think they're making sense of these two issues, and how do you think they should be making sense of them?
So let's start with Cuba, because I think Cuba is actually, believe it or not, the more straightforward policy issue, which is, you know, Joe Biden has said what you would want a U.S. president to say on this, which is that we respect democracy and human rights. We call for the Cuban government to, you know, end its repressive policies. That's not terribly surprising. The question is whether the Cuban government is actually going to make any changes, or do they continue to stay in power? And I will say this is a rare moment where it's worth seeing how this plays out. History provides so many instances in which the Cuban communist regime was predicted to be down and out, and it nonetheless persevered, that, you know, you could just attribute the protests as a one-off and essentially the state apparatus will crack down again. You know, that said, it's clear that Cuba was very hard hit by the pandemic, both in terms of the loss of tourism revenue, as well as COVID-19 sort of running roughshod over the country. Also, their traditional benefactors are in even worse straits than they are. So, you know, it used to be that the Soviet Union obviously took care of Cuba. Until recently, it was Venezuela. But Venezuela can barely keep its own country together, much less assist Cuba. So it would be interesting. And then finally, the one thing that always kept the Cuban Communist Party in power was the legitimacy of the Castro brothers in terms of their ability, the fact that they had overthrown Batista, and, you know, that the revolution, at least at the time that it occurred, was generally considered somewhat popular. The Castros are leaving the scene. As a result, you have leaders in Cuba that don't have the same kind of charismatic legitimacy that they had. And so there are some reasons to believe that the regime might be somewhat more fragile than we thought.
Is there something the Biden team should do in this case? Should they put more pressure on? I've heard calls for them to lessen the pressure on the regime, or they just sort of sit tight because they don't want to become sort of the target of the Cuban regime, which is going to do what it always does, which is say, we have these problems because of the Americans.
Which is what they've already done, by the way, in response to the protests. If I were the Biden administration, I would advise them to sit tight. You don't necessarily want to crank up the sanctions further. First of all, we've already cranked up the sanctions about as much as we can. I'm not sure there's much more to crank up. And also, you know, any further move in that area is just going to hurt the Cuban population much more than it hurts the Cuban elite. That said, I also don't think you lessen the sanctions. I think you see, can the Cuban government weather the storm or not? And then go from there. The Haiti situation is weirder in that the assassination of the Haitian president, certainly the U.S. was not behind it, but there are too many U.S. connections to make me comfortable that it seems like there was a U.S. private security company that was contracted out to engage in this sort of activity by someone who was born in Haiti, but then had spent time in Florida. I think what's interesting here, as you say, is that the Haitian government has basically asked for whether the Biden administration could send troops, and the Biden administration said, no, we're not really going to do that, which is generally not surprising, because as you say, and as I said before, it's not like the Biden administration really wants to have boots on the ground in a lot of places. That said, you know, the problem with trouble in the Caribbean is always, it's a little bit different from Afghanistan. The Caribbean really is America's backyard. If there was ever a place where you think that the United States should consider active military intervention, it would presumably be in some place like the Caribbean.
Though the track record on that score isn't particularly good.
No, it's not. But the other issue is, basically my hunch, this is very cynical, but I nonetheless think it's true. What will drive the Biden administration on its policy towards Haiti is, do you start seeing waves of refugees coming across the Caribbean to try to land in Florida? If instability in Haiti or instability in Cuba causes a surge of refugees to cross over or to attempt to cross, that will be the thing that prompts the Biden administration to take more proactive action, because, you know, they don't want to feed the story of rising tides of migrants, which is already an area where it's not exactly the Biden administration's strong suit. Short of that, no, I don't think they're necessarily going to do all that much.
On that note, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Dan Dresner, Professor of International Politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and the author of Toddler in Chief, What Donald Trump Teaches Us About the Modern Presidency. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.